The awful price exacted by this system was the inevitable breakup of the family. For the time would come when this child, with his precious documents, would leave Mexico forever. But the good part was that when, as a young man, he established his American citizenship, he could send down to Moctezuma and bring in his entire family under the compassion rule. So once Euphemia gained entrance to Thomason General, she was guaranteeing future American citizenship for herself and perhaps as many as a dozen family members. "Make no mistake," warned an older man who had worked as an illegal in Texas. "Many things happen up there that no one in his right mind would wish, but it's better than here. It's worth the risk." Candido and his sister caught a ride north with one of the Pemex trucks, and as they neared Juarez, the driver said, "You understand, it's easy to cross over into El Paso. Anyone can do that. But it's hell to slip out of the city and move north. Guards and stops everywhere." "I don't intend to stay," Candido said, and the driver said, "They all say that. When you see it, you'll want to." Although Juarez was a large city, they had no difficulty in finding El Lobo. "I'll get your sister to the hospital at the right time. I can also take you to fine cities in Texas, Candido. Lots of work." "I'm not staying." "For $15, all the way to Fort Stockton, and a good job." "Just my sister." It was agreed that Candido would accompany her to the first stopping house and would, at the appropriate time, move her close to the hospital. And he did this effectively, so that Euphemia had a minimum of worry. At the stopping place, six other pregnant women counseled with her, and she watched as they moved on to the American hospital. She saw two of them when they returned with their babies, both girls, and displayed the precious birth certificates. "You are so lucky," she said, and they replied, "We know you'll be lucky, too." She was. With the skill of an expert, Candido moved her nearer the hospital, and when her labor pains became intense, he led her to the emergency entrance, where a young intern with a mustache cried, "Here's another Aztec princess." And before Candido could ask even one question, his sister was whisked away. It cost the city of El Paso about $1,200 to deliver a Mexican baby and care for the mother prior to release. But the most Thomason General could extract from the constant stream of pregnant women was $75 each, and most, like Euphemia, could pay nothing. Why did Texas allow this preposterous system? "I'll tell you," Officer Talbot explained to a newspaper man from Chicago. "We're a compassionate people down here. We do not turn away pregnant women. But we also like the cheap labor the Mexicans provide. Mercy and profit, one of the most rewarding combinations in world history." The Pemex driver had been right. Once Candido saw the riches of El Paso and the good life available to even poor Mexicans, he wanted to stay, not in that crowded city, but in the hinterland, where he heard the jobs were plentiful. And this desire tempted him to come back across the international bridge as soon as he placed his sister and her baby on the Pemex truck heading south. Since he did not purchase the services of El Lobo, he was able to penetrate only a few miles past the immigration blockades when a tall Border Patrol officer named Talbot detected him on the road and sent him back to Mexico. On his next try, he did use El Lobo, who put him well inland. But again, he had the bad luck of running into Officer Talbot, a misfortune that was repeated on his third attempt. "Haven't I seen you before?" Talbot asked. And this time, when he shoved the boy across the border, he warned, "Next time, jail." So Candido, with his burning memories of riches in the United States, returned to Moctezuma. But in June of the following year, when he was 18 and working at his brother-in-law's garage, his younger sister Manuela informed her family that she wanted to try to get into the United States. And again, the women of Moctezuma decided that Candido should take her to Juarez, where, for $15, El Lobo would lead her not into El Paso, where she would be apprehended if she tried to sneak past Officer Talbot, but to a safe crossing he had developed some 70 miles to the east. Said a man who had used that route under El Lobo's guidance, "It's not easy. You cross the Rio Grande, walk inland about a mile, and a truck picks you up. Costs another $15, but you can't make it alone. Candido, warn your sister that she cannot make it alone." For Candido, the next days were agonizing, because the old longing to get into the United States revived. But he knew that if he went, he would leave his mother alone. Euphemia married, Manuela gone. If I go, who's left to help? But then he began to think of his sister. I can't leave her in a truck at the edge of the desert. By the time he and his sister were ready to board the Pemex truck, he had not made up his mind. But as he said farewell to his mother, he embraced her with unusual ardor and burst into tears. She must have known what tormented him, for she said, "Do whatever's right." When they reached Ciudad Juarez, and Candido actually saw El Lobo again, he knew he must not leave Manuela in that man's corrupt hands. So, without having made a major decision himself, he eased into the Lobo operation, reserving the right to back out at the last moment. The truck carrying the would-be emigrants left Juarez at 5 p.m. with 17 passengers, 11 men and 6 women, at $15 a head, and drove southeast along a bumpy road traveled by other trucks returning empty from the trip to the crossing. At dusk, the emigrants pulled up at a lonely spot east of Banderas, and there Candido had to make up his mind. "Well, are you joining them or not? $15 if you do." And on the spot, the boy said, "I'll stay with my sister." At this place, the Rio Grande was so shallow that the Mexicans could walk almost completely across, needing to swim only the last few yards to the American side. And there, the American guides had stationed 2 Mexican men who helped the women. When all were safely ashore, El Lobo blinked his lights and was gone. They had come to some of the loneliest land in Texas, that stretch along the river which not even the hardiest settlers had attempted to tame. Rocky in parts, steeply graded, bereft of trees, with only dirt trails leading inland, it was a terrain so forbidding that Candido was glad he had stayed with his sister. "This is dangerous. Stay close to me." The 18 wetbacks were led to a miserable truck, which had bounced over these roads many times. But before they were allowed to climb in, a man named Hansen growled, $15, and I put you on a back road to Fort Stockton." He stood in the shaded glare of the headlights, verifying the payments. And when all were accounted for, he piled the Mexicans in and started north. But as he drove, a cohort rode atop the cab of the truck, keeping a shotgun aimed at the passengers. "Don't no one try to jump off," he warned. "We don't want to show La Migra how we move about." There was a moon, rising at about 9 and throwing only modified light. But it was enough to permit the Mexicans to see the wild terrain they were traversing. "Oh, this can't be Estados Unidos," a woman cried. And the gunman replied in Spanish, "It sure is. 300 miles of it." At 4 a.m, when they were far from the river, the driver, seeing a chance to earn a lot of money with no responsibility, made the engine cough and then conk out. "Damn it," he cried, "we've got to fix this." And he ordered the Mexicans to leave the truck and stand well back while he worked on it. To their delight, the engine began to sputter, caught, and then purred nicely. At these welcome sounds, the Mexicans started toward the truck, when, to their horror, the 2 Anglos revved the motor and took off across the desert, leaving the wetbacks stranded, with no guide, no food, and worst of all, no water. It was a trip into hell. At 10 a.m. of the second day, when the sun was blazing high, the first Mexican died, a man in his 40s whose swollen tongue filled his mouth. An hour later, 6 others were dead, but the 2 Guzmans still survived. "Manuela," Candido whispered, "we must look for plants, anything." They found nothing, none of the big cacti which often saved lives in such circumstances. and by noon, three more were dead. Overhead, the sky was an arch of blue. Not a blemish obscured the sun, which beat mercilessly on the hapless Mexicans. 2 o'clock passed, with more than half the wetbacks, ironic name, dead, and in the late afternoon, in that dreadful heat, Manuela gasped one last plea for water, stared madly at her brother, and died. 3 men made it to U.S. 80, 140 miles west of Fort Stockton. In despair, they tried to flag down motorists. None stopped. Candido finally threw himself in front of an approaching car, while his companions waved frantically. But they did not need to do this, for the man driving the car was Officer Talbot, who had been searching for them. "Poor sons of bitches," he said to his partner. "Let's get them something to drink." They drove eastward to Van Horn, where Talbot tossed the 3 in jail, but not before providing them with all the liquid they could drink. They were returned to Mexico, of course, and since Candido was too ashamed to go back to Moctezuma to inform his family of Manuela's death and of how it had occurred, he slipped back into El Paso, found a job, saved his money, bought a gun, grew a mustache so as to alter his appearance, and went back to El Lobo as if he had never seen him before. "Is it true you take people into Los Estados Unidos?" $15 to me, $15 to the men on the other side. "I'll go. I'll take you through the barriers in North El Paso. I was told there was a better crossing at Banderas. You want to go that way? All right." This time, a party of 19 illegals drove beside the Rio Grande to the little town, where the emigrants paid their fee and swam the river. On the far side, Hansen was waiting with his same rickety truck, the same shotgun assistant. They left the river at dusk, rode through the night, and at about 3 in the morning, the truck broke down again. "Move over here while we fix it," Hansen said. But as he spoke, Candido and 2 other wetbacks whom he had recruited en route shot him and the assistant dead. Commandeering the truck, they sped toward where U.S. 80 would have to be, and long before dawn they were at the outskirts of Fort Stockton. Disposing of the truck in a gully, they shook hands and made their way variously into the town and into the fabric of American life. Candido, moving alone along the highway, started back west to give the impression, if questioned by police regarding the desert murders, that he had been in the States for some time. But he had walked only a few miles when he was met by a pickup roaring eastward from El Paso. As soon as the driver spotted Candido, whom he easily identified as a wetback, he screeched to a halt. "What you looking for, son?" The driver was a big, florid man in his late 30s, dressed like a sheriff, and he terrified Candido, who whispered, "Solamente español, señor." Whereupon the man surprised him by saying in easy Spanish, "Amigo, if you seek work, you've met the right man." He invited Candido to sit beside him, and together they rode to Fort Stockton, and a short distance to the north, when they came upon a frontier ranch with an ornate stone gate and a sign which said, "El Rancho Estupendo, Lorenzo Quimper, proprietor." "Come in and grab yourself some grub," the rancher said. And in this way, Candido Guzman became a permanent resident of the United States, and a lifelong employee of Lorenzo Quimper, who owned some 9 ranches for which he needed reliable workmen. Few immigrants had ever dared so much to find haven in Texas. Few would serve it more faithfully. In the city of Detroit, things were not going well for the Morrisons. Todd, the father, could see that within a few more months his branch of the Chrysler Corporation might have to shut down. The axe had already fallen on his wife, Maggie, for one Friday morning 3 weeks earlier, the principal of her school had handed her the gray-toned sheet of paper teachers dreaded. "The Cascade Public Schools District Board of Education, meeting in regular session, voted last night to take certain actions necessary for its survival. It is my duty to inform you that your teaching contract will not be renewed upon its expiration at the close of the 1968 spring term, and both your job and your salary will end at that time." The Morrisons were aware that even with the loss of Maggie's income, they could survive if Todd kept his job. But there was an additional aggravation. Their two children, Beth, an extremely bright 13, and Lonnie, aged 11, had already stated that under no circumstances did they want to leave the Cascade schools, which they had grown to love and which enrolled all their friends. The Morrisons had long practiced the art of family democracy, with ample discussion of most problems, and they did not back off from this unpleasant one. "Kids, if things get worse at Chrysler, I'm going to get laid off. What then?" "That would be horribly unfair," Beth cried. "They fired your mother, didn't they?" "Yes, but the school board's a bunch of cruds." "We must consider the possibilities if I do lose my job," Todd said. "You could become a policeman," Lonnie suggested. "The news had an article about needing more cops." "Not my age and not my salary," his father replied. He was 37, his wife 33, at the exact time in their lives when they needed every penny to enjoy the amenities they treasured. A good movie now and then, books, and to afford careful attention to health, orthodontics, a sensible diet, durable clothes. And these cost money. Their house carried only a $6,000 mortgage, and they had never been extravagant with cars or socializing. They drove one new Plymouth and one very old Ford. Normally, they should have been at the cresting point in their careers, with Todd looking forward to rapid promotion and Maggie being considered for a principalship. Now the bottom was falling out of their world, and they could not even guess where the terrifying drop would end. "Well, what shall we do if I'm fired?" Todd asked again. And his three advisors sat silent, so he explored the subject. "Ford and GM won't take me on, that's for sure. Stated frankly, my type of work is ended unless I can find a job in Japan." The Morrisons laughed at this suggestion, but then Beth asked, "Transfer? What's a practical possibility?" "I don't really know. For your mother, no school jobs in these parts, nor in places like New York. But I hear there are openings in California and boom towns like Atlanta." "I'm attracted to neither," Beth said bluntly in her surprisingly adult manner, whereupon her mother said, "You'll like whatever we have to do, Miss Beth, and remember that." And the girl said, "I know. I don't want to leave Cascade, but if we have to, we have to." "I vote for California," Lonnie said. "Surfing." Todd ignored this suggestion. "I really think I'll have to start looking for a new job." "What could you do?" Beth asked. "I'm good at what I do." "Yes, you are, dear," Maggie said quickly. "I can keep an organization on its toes. Maybe labor relations. Maybe selling something." "Death of a salesman," Beth cried. "Willie Loman of the auto trade." "You'd be awfully good at labor relations," Maggie said as she cleared the table. "But where?" The next 3 weeks passed in growing apprehension as Maggie Morrison applied to one school district after another. The results were not depressing. They were terrifying. At night, she told her family, "Enrollments dropping everywhere in the city. Everyone suggests we move to some new area. We may have to." In the month that followed, the spate of news from Chrysler was so depressing that Todd could barely discuss it with his family. And it was at one of these doleful meetings that the word Texas was first voiced. Todd said, "I hear that electronics is real big in the Dallas area. If they're expanding..." Beth said she did not want to go to Texas. Too big, too noisy. But Lonnie could hardly wait to get started. Cowboys. Wow. On the next Friday night, Todd was fired. In their despair, the Morrisons organized as a team. Todd studied the want ads. Maggie continued to seek work as a teacher or even as a teacher's helper. Beth, with remarkable maturity, took charge of the housework, and Lonnie volunteered for extra chores. But each week, the family savings declined, and the children knew it. Todd applied for 36 different jobs and was rejected each time. "I'm too old for this, too young for that. I know both the assembly line and sales, but can't land a job in either. This is one hell of a time to be out of work." It was Maggie who found him a job, and she did it in a most peculiar way. She was in the industrial section of the city, interviewing at a school for children with special problems, when she met a woman whose husband worked for a firm that had developed a new line of business. What they do, Todd, they overhaul automobile engines. They have new diagnostic machines to spot weaknesses, other machines to fix them. They've had real success in Detroit and Cleveland, and they want to franchise widely. This woman said there were real opportunities. Early next morning, Todd was at the new company's office, and he learned that what his wife had reported was true. Engine experts had hit upon a system for adding years to the life of the average automobile engine and its subordinate parts. Intricate new machines diagnosed trouble spots and instructed the workmen how to repair them. The initial cost of the system was rather high, but the cash return of the four installations that Todd was allowed to inspect was reassuring, and he entered into serious discussion with the owners. "What we want to do," the energetic man said, "is break into the Dallas-Houston market. Go where the cars are, that's our motto." "I don't have the funds to buy in," Todd said truthfully. But the men said, "We don't want you to. You know cars. You have common sense. We want you to go to Texas, scout out the good locations, what we call the inevitables, and buy us an option on the corner where the most cars pass, but where an industrial shop would be allowed. Would you be interested?" "What are the chances I'd fall on my ass?" "We'd carry you for 1 year, sink or swim. But we think you'd swim, especially in Texas, where they have poor public transportation and people are nuts about their cars." They offered Todd a year's assignment in Texas, Dallas or Houston as he wished, during which he was to identify 8 locations and arrange for the purchase of real estate and the issuance of licenses to open engine experts' shops. That night, he handed his wife and children pencils and paper and asked them to take notes as he lined out their situation. 6 months ago, this family had income as follows. Father, $26,000. Mother, $8,000. Total, how much, Lonnie? $34,000. "Well, we both lost our jobs. Salary right now, zero. We can get something for the house. Our savings go steadily down, but still $19,000. Should have been a lot more, but we didn't anticipate." "We can cut back," Beth said. "I don't need special lessons." "We can all cut back or starve. I've been offered a job in Texas." "Hooray," Lonnie cried. "Can I have a horse?" "The salary will be $18,000, with promise of a bonus if I do well." "You'll do well," Maggie said. It was agreed. The Todd Morrisons of Michigan, a family deeply embedded in that state, would move to Houston, Texas. On a morning in July 1968, with tears marking all their faces, they left Michigan forever and headed south. They did not paint on their truck the ancient sign GTT, but they could have, for the social disruptions which were forcing them south were almost identical with those which had spurred the migrations to Texas in 1820 and 1850. They, too, were in search of a better life. In that summer of 1968, a different family of immigrants, mother, father, 4 daughters, moved quietly into the oil town of Larkin, and within 3 weeks had the owners of better-class homes in a rage. They were such a rowdy lot, especially the mother, that an observer might have thought, "The rip-roaring boom days of 1922 are back." They were night people, always a bad sign, who seemed to do most of their hell-raising after dark, with mother and daughters off on a toot marked by noise, vandalism, and other furtive acts. They operated as a gang, with their weak and ineffective father along at times, and what infuriated the townsfolk particularly was that they seemed to take positive joy in their depredations. Despite their unfavorable reputation, and many sins were charged against them which they did not commit, they really did more good than harm. They were an asset to the community, and they had about them elements of extraordinary beauty, which their enemies refused to admit. They were armadillos, never known in this area before. a group of invaders who had moved up from Mexico, bringing irritation and joy wherever they appeared. Opponents of the fascinating little creatures, which were no bigger than small dogs, accused them of eating quail eggs, a rotten lie, of raiding chicken coops, false as could be, and of tearing up fine lawns, a just charge and a serious one. Ranchers also said, "They dig so many holes that my cattle stumble into them and break their legs. There goes $400." The indictment involving the digging up of lawns and the making of other deep holes was justified, for no animal could dig faster than an armadillo. And when this mother and her four daughters turned themselves loose on a neat lawn or a nicely tilled vegetable garden, their destruction could be awesome. The armadillo had a long, probing snout, backed up by 2 forefeet, each with 4 3-inch claws, and 2 hind feet with 5 shovel-like claws, and the speed with which it could work those excavators was unbelievable. "Straight down," Mr. Kramer said. "They can dig faster than I can with a shovel. The nose feels out the soft spots, and those 4 legs drive like pistons. But it's the back legs that amaze, because they catch the loose earth and throw it 4 or 5 feet backwards." Mr. Kramer was one of those odd men found in all communities who measured rainfall on a regular basis, phoning the information to the weather service, and who recorded the depth of snowfall, the time of the first frost, the strength and direction of the wind during storms, and the fact that in the last blue norther, the temperature on a fine March day dropped in the space of 3 hours from 26.9 to 9.7 degrees Celsius. He was the type who always gave the temperature in Celsius, which he expected his friends to translate into Fahrenheit if they wished. He was, in short, a 62-year-old former member of an oil crew who had always loved nature and who had poked his bullet-cropped, sandy-haired head into all sorts of corners. The first armadillos to reach Larkin were identified on a Tuesday, and by Friday, Mr. Kramer had written away for 3 research studies on the creatures. The more he read, the more he grew to like them, and before long he was defending them against their detractors, especially to those whose lawns had been excavated. "A little damage here and there, I grant you, but did you hear about what they did for my rose bushes? Laden down with beetles they were, couldn't produce 1 good flower even with toxic sprays. Then one night I look out to check the moon, 3/4 full, and I see these pairs of beady eyes shining in the gloom, and across my lawn come these 5 armadillos. And I say to myself, 'Uh-oh, there goes the lawn.' But that wasn't the case at all. Those armadillos were after those beetles, and when I woke up in the morning to check the rain gauge, what do you suppose? Not 1 beetle to be found." Mr. Kramer defended the little creatures to anyone who would listen, but not many cared. "You ever see his tongue? Darts out about 6 inches long, very sticky. Zoom, there goes another ant, another beetle. He was made to police the garden and knock off the pests." Once, when a Mrs. Cole was complaining with a bleeding heart about what the armadillos had done to her lawn, he stopped her with a rather revolting question. "Mrs. Cole, have you ever inspected an armadillo's stomach?" "Well, I have, many times. Dissected bodies I've found along the highway. And what does the stomach contain? Bugs, beetles, delicate roots, flies, ants, all the crawling things you don't like. And you can tell Mr. Cole that in 17 autopsies I've never found even the trace of a bird's egg, and certainly no quail eggs." By the time he was through with his report on the belly of an armadillo, Mrs. Cole was more than ever opposed to the destructive little beasts. But it was when he extolled the beauty of the armadillo that he lost the support of even the most sympathetic Larkin citizens. For they saw the little animal as an awkward, low-slung relic of some past geologic age that had mysteriously survived into the present. One look at the creature convinced them that it should have died out with the dinosaurs, and its survival into the 20th century somehow offended them. To Mr. Kramer, this heroic persistence was one of the armadillo's great assets. But he was even more impressed by the beauty of its design. "Armadillo, what does it mean? the little armored one. And if you look at him dispassionately, what you see is a beautifully designed animal, much like one of the armored horses they used to have in the Middle Ages. The back, the body, the legs are all protected by this amazing armor, beautifully fashioned to flow across the body of the beast. And look at the engineering. When he said this, he liked to display one of the three armadillos he had tamed when their parents were killed by hunters, and point to the miracle of which he was speaking. This is real armor, fore and aft. Punch it. Harder than your fingernail, and made of the same substance. Protects the shoulders and the hips. But here in the middle, nine flexible bands of armor, much like an accordion. Always nine, never seven or ten. And without these inserts, the beast couldn't move about as he does. Quite wonderful, really. Nothing like it in the rest of the animal kingdom. Real relic of the dinosaur age. But he would never let it end at that, and it was what he said next that did win some converts to the armadillo's defense. What awes me is not the armor, nor the nine flexible plates. They're just good engineering. But the beauty of the design goes beyond engineering. It's art, and only a designer who took infinite care could have devised these patterns. Leonardo da Vinci, maybe, or Michelangelo, or even God. And then he would show how, fore and aft, the armor was composed of the most beautiful hexagons and pentagons arranged like golden coins upon a field of exquisite gray cloth, while the nine bands were entirely different. Look at the curious structures. Elongated capital A's. Go ahead, tell me what they look like. A field of endless oil derricks, aren't they? Can't you see? He's the good luck symbol of the whole oil industry. His coming to Larkin was no mistake. He was sent here to serve as our mascot. How beautiful, how mysterious the armadillos were when one took the trouble to inspect them seriously, as Mr. Kramer did. They bespoke past ages, the death of great systems, the miracle of creation and survival. They were walking reminders of a time when volcanoes peppered the earth and vast lakes covered continents. They were hallowed creatures, for they had seen the earth before man arrived, and they had survived to remind him of how things once had been. They should have died out with Tyrannosaurus Rex and Diplodocus, but they had stubbornly persisted so that they could bear testimony, and for the value of that testimony, they were precious and worthy of defense. They must continue into the future, Mr. Kramer said, so that future generations can see how things once were. What amazes, Mr. Kramer told the women he tried to persuade, is their system of giving birth. Invariably, four pups, and invariably all four identicals of the same sex. There is no case of a mother armadillo giving birth to boys and girls at the same time. Impossible. And do you know why? Because one fertilized egg is split into four parts. Rarely more, rarely less. Therefore, the resulting babies have to be of the same sex. But would you believe this? The mother can hold that fertilized four-part egg in her womb for the normal 8 weeks, or, if things don't seem propitious, for as long as 22 months, same as the elephant. She gives birth in response to some perceived need, and what that is, no one can say. As he brooded about this mystery of birth, wondering how the armadillo community ensured that enough males and females would be provided to keep the race going, he visualized what he called the great computer in the sky, which kept track of how many four-girl births were building up in a given community. And some morning it clicks out a message, "Hey, we need a couple of four-boy births in the Larkin area." So the next females to become pregnant have four male babies, and the grand balance is maintained. Mr. Kramer could find no one who wished to share his speculation on this mystery, but as he pursued it, he began to think about human beings, too. What grand computer ensures that we have a balance between male and female babies? And how does it make the adjustments it does? Like after a war, when a lot of men have died in battle. Normal births in peacetime 1,004 males to 1,000 females, because males are more delicate in the early years and have to be protected numerically. But after a war, when the great computer knows that there's a deficiency in males, the balance swings as high as 1,009 to 1,000. So when he looked at an armadillo on its way to dig in his lawn, he saw not a destructive little tank with incredibly powerful digging devices, but a symbol of the grandeur of creation, the passing of time, the mystery of birth, the great beauty that exists in the world in so many different manifestations. An armadillo is not one whit more beautiful or mysterious than a butterfly or a pine cone, but it's more fun. And what gave him the warmest satisfaction? All the other sizable animals of the world seem to be having their living areas reduced. Only the armadillo is stubbornly enlarging his. Sometimes, when he watched this mother and her four daughters heading forth for some new devastation, he chuckled with delight. There they go, the five horsewomen of the apocalypse. Another Larkin man had a much different name for the little excavators. Ransom Rusk, principal heir and sole operator of the Rusk Holdings in the Larkin Field, had a fierce desire to obliterate memories of his unfortunate ancestry. The grand fool Earnshaw Rusk, the wife with the wooden nose, his own obscenely obese father, his fat, foolish mother. He wanted to forget them all. He was a tall, lean man, quite handsome, totally unlike his father, and at 45 he was at the height of his powers. He had married a Wellesley graduate from New England, and it was amusing that her mother, wishing to dissociate herself from her cotton mill ancestry, had named her daughter Florette, trusting that something of French gentility would brush off. Florette and Ransom Rusk, fed up with the modest house in whose kitchen Floyd had maintained his oil office till he died, had employed an architect from Boston to build them a mansion, and he had suggested an innovation which would distinguish their place from others in the region. It is very fashionable in the better estates of England to have a bowling green. It could also be used for croquet, should you prefer, and Florette had applauded the idea. It was now her pleasure to entertain at what she called a pleasant afternoon of bowls, and she did indeed make it pleasant. Not many of the local millionaires, and there were now some 24 in the Larkin district, thanks to those reliable wells which never produced much more than 100 barrels a day, rarely less, knew how to play bowls. But they had fun at the variations they devised. Ransom Rusk, as the man who dominated the Larkin field, was not spectacularly rich by Texas standards, whose categories were popularly defined, 1 to 20 million, comfortable, 20 to 50 million, well-to-do, 50 to 500 million, rich, 500 million to 1 billion, big rich, 1 to 5 billion, Texas rich. By virtue of his other oil holdings in various parts of the state, and his prudent investments in Fort Worth Ventures, he was now rich, but in the lowest ranks of that middle division. His attitudes toward wealth were contradictory, for obviously he had a driving ambition to acquire and exercise power in its various manifestations, and in pursuit of this he strove to multiply his wealth. But he remained indifferent to its mathematical level, often spending an entire year without knowing his balances or even an approximation of them. Impelled by an urge to control billions, he did not care to count them. On the other hand, he had inherited his father's shrewd judgment regarding oil and had extended it to the field of general financing, and he always sought new opportunities and knew how to apply leverage when he found them. He was brooding about his Fort Worth adventures one morning when he heard Florette scream, "Oh, my God!" Thinking that she had fallen, he rushed into the bedroom to find her standing by the window, pointing wordlessly at the havoc which had been wreaked upon her bowling green. "Looks like an atom bomb," Ransom said. "It's those damned armadillos." But Florette did not hear his explanation, for she was wailing as if she had lost three children. "Shut up," Ransom cried. "I'll take care of those little bastards." He slammed out of the house, inspected the chopped-up bowling lawn, and summoned the gardeners. "Can this be fixed?" "We can resod it like new, Mr. Rusk," they assured him, "but you'll have to keep them armadillos out." "I'll take care of them. I'll shoot them." In pursuit of this plan, he went to the hardware store to buy a stack of ammo for his .22 rifle. But while there, he happened to stand beside Mr. Kramer at the checkout counter, and the retired oilman, who had worked for Rusk, asked, "What are the bullets for?" And unfortunately, Ransom said, "Armadillos." "Oh, you mustn't do that. Those are precious creatures. You should be protecting them, not killing them." "They tore up my wife's lawn last night." "Her bowling green? I've heard it's beautiful. Cost God knows how much, and it's in shreds." "A minor difficulty," Kramer said lightly, since he did not have to pay for the repairs. And before Ransom could get away, the enthusiastic nature lover had drawn him to the drugstore, where they shared Dr. Pepper's. "Did you know, Ransom, that we have highly accurate maps showing the progress north of the armadillo, maybe the only record of its kind?" "I wish they'd stayed where they came from." "They came from Mexico." "One hell of a lot comes from Mexico. Wetbacks, boll weevils." A follower of the great Audubon first recorded them in Texas, down along the Rio Grande in 1854. They had reached San Antonio by 1880, Austin by 1914, Jefferson in the east by 1945. They were slower, reaching our drier area. They were reported in Dallas in 1953, but they didn't reach us till this year. Remarkable march. "Should have kept them in Mexico," Rusk said, fingering his box of shells. "They're in Florida, too. Three pairs escaped from a zoo in 1922, and people transported them as pets. They liked Florida, so now they move east from Texas and west from Florida. They'll occupy the entire Gulf area before this century is out." "They aren't going to occupy my place much longer," Ransom said. And that was the beginning of the hilarious adventure, because Mr. Kramer persuaded him, almost tearfully, not to shoot the armadillos, but to keep them away from the bowling green by building protection around it. "These are unique creatures, relics of the past, and they do an infinite amount of good."